Hi, it's Mark Graben here. If you are a fan of our podcast, you'll want to attend a free webinar that we'll be presenting October 18th, 1 o'clock Eastern. I'll be presenting with Ken Siegel, the CEO of Value Capture. It's titled Seizing the Healthcare Safety Opportunity Using the Playbook of Paul O'Neill. You can register for the free webinar by going to valuecapturellc.com/webinars. We hope you'll join us live, or if you hear this after October 18th, you can register to get the recording sent to you. So again, valuecapturellc.com/webinars. Welcome to Habitual Excellence, presented by Value Capture. This podcast and our firm is all about helping you and your organization achieve habitual excellence via one unifying focus, one value-based structure, and one performance system. In other words, it's about helping you capture dramatically more value through achieving perfect care and perfect safety for patients and staff. To learn more about Value Capture and our services, visit www.valuecapturellc.com. Well, hi, and welcome to Habitual Excellence. I'm Mark Graben. Our guest today is Susan Moffitt-Bruce. She is, among other things, a thoracic surgeon. She is the chief executive officer at the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada, and she was previously executive director of the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center University Hospital. So before I tell you a little bit more about Susan, let me first say welcome. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here today. Thank you so much for having me.
And so Susan's had many roles. She was the OSU Wexner Medical Center's first chief quality and patient safety officer, where she and her team were celebrated for their success in reducing patient safety events and hospital readmissions. So we'll have an opportunity to talk about that and a lot more today. She's trained with our friends at Intermountain Healthcare, our friends at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Now I need to call everybody. I say there's pressure. I don't know the people at the Harvard School of Public Health, but they're good people too. Susan has a Six Sigma Black Belt certification, and she earned her Master's of Business Operational Excellence and her Executive MBA at the Fisher College of Business at The Ohio State University. Our friends there at the MBOE program. So, Susan, thank you again for joining us. And you know, we're going to talk about continuous improvement on a number of levels here today. First off, I'm curious, from your background as a surgeon or a hospital leader, like at what point in your career did you really get interested in the practice of continuous improvement?
Excellent question, Mark. I think that if I look back, and maybe as a surgeon, always been invested and really interested in continuous improvement. I think as a surgeon, we're problem solvers. You come to us either with a diagnosis or an issue that needs to be remedied or helped. And so we're always looking at ways to improve the outcomes of our patients, to improve their lives. And so that's kind of a case-by-case basis, right? Patient by patient, family by family. And then fast forward, when I became the inaugural Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer, I'd only been in practice for about 5 years. And so I had to shift my focus from individual patients and families to a system that was taking care of thousands of patients a year at, over 1,500 beds. So at any one time, we had, really a large number of patients to care for. And although I had done it on a singular basis or on a case by case basis, I didn't have the skills to apply continuous improvement to a system. And I really thought, if I can do it on a small scale, a model cell, I know it's called now, how can I apply it on a larger system base to improve outcomes ultimately as well? And that's when I really got interested in the science behind continuous improvement.
So it'd be interesting to hear you elaborate on when you talk about the science of continuous improvement. What does that mean to you?
Well, excellent question. And I think in the beginning, when I first started as being really a learner and a student of continuous improvement, I knew that there are ways in which you could take a problem, analyze it, apply solutions, and measure. But I didn't quite understand the tools. So I think understanding continuous improvement is really understanding the tools that are used at the right time, in the right instance, with the right teams, and ultimately then using the right tools to measure whether or not you really have improved a process, always in that kind of learning cycle. And so that takes some discipline to learn those tools. I think it takes some discipline to understand where they're applied. And then it takes discipline to share the usage of those tools with the teams that you're working with in order to improve the outcomes for patient populations.
Mm-hmm. So are there parallels? You talked about, you know, surgeon as problem solver. Are there parallels in some of the thought process that helps other surgeons or other physicians relate to the science of continuous improvement?
I think there are many parallels, actually. And I think that's why those surgeons, those physicians that become involved in continuous improvement usually find it to be very satisfying and not totally dissimilar to how we were trained. For instance, you know, in my instance, you know, I'm a cardiac surgeon by training and thoracic surgeon by training. And so there's a group of diseases that I am trained to deal with. I have to look at the diagnosis. I have to look at the treatments. I have to look at what the desired outcomes are. Similarly, if you're in a healthcare system and you want to reduce, say, falls, you know, what's the problem? How do you apply the solutions? And how do you measure the outcomes? So whether or not it's a disease or a care paradigm that you want to influence, the processes and the applications of the science are not dissimilar. Mm-hmm.
I can imagine. I mean, I say this or ask this as an engineer, I would hope, like when I'm a patient, that a doctor or a surgeon is not jumping to solutions, kind of like the way we would to avoid doing in continuous improvement.
Yeah, well, it's very, very interesting. I think that oftentimes we may, because we're very problem, very solutions focused. Sometimes we do jump to a solution, which is why we teach our residents and our medical students to always look at what's called a differential diagnosis. What could be one of many diagnoses? Get the right tests, look at the patient, the exam, the situation that's going on clinically, and then come to the ultimate diagnosis and treatment. So it is a process, and that's how we have to teach our residents and our students really how to be patient and to apply the science of clinical diagnoses, mm-hmm. not dissimilar to continuous improvement.
Yeah, diagnosing the problem, understanding the problem.
Absolutely.
And then I appreciate the connection to measures. Like there may be some small improvements. We can think of an example where we just know that's, It's better, and maybe we don't need to measure. But for, you know, more complicated problems, or I would hope as a patient, maybe this is easier when it comes to, let's say, medication. If the doctor understands, okay, we agree there's a problem, there's a diagnosis, there could be a countermeasure of some medication, but then there's probably lab results or measurements.
That's right.
To then evaluate when we tried something, how do we don't assume that that solution is working. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that, maybe even on the continuous improvement side of it.
It's an excellent example, Mark. So say you're treating a patient with maybe a type of cancer. You give them a certain chemotherapy. You're then going to see whether or not the cancerous area has shrunken. That's the outcome metric that you're going to be measuring. And you're going to measure that for the lifetime of the patient. Similarly, in continuous improvement, if you're trying to reduce, say, an infection rate amongst intensive care patients, again, you're going to implement some changes. You're going to measure whether or not that actual metric, that the incidence of those infections have decreased, and you're going to continue to measure, because if you don't continue to measure, you're sure to fall back into maybe some of the or a lack of the processes that are needed to make sure that those outcomes are very, very good.
Yeah. And then one other, maybe, I don't know if there's a parallel here, but we've probably heard this phrase, every patient is unique. And I wonder if there's an so how do we find the balance? We might say every problem is unique. Every continuous improvement opportunity is unique. Like, when do we rely on frameworks? If we have a consistent framework for unique situations, is that useful in either medicine or continuous improvement?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I think that every patient is unique. However, I think that with whatever clinical disease you're dealing with, there's a certain way to approach it. That's the science. And then the art of medicine is applying the science in a way that is the best for that patient. With a lot of our molecular testing now, we know that if a patient has a certain type of cancer, that they need a certain type of chemotherapy. But if you can then look at what genes are being expressed in that cancer, you can actually fine tune, you know, personalized medicine is very much a bit of an art based on the science of that medicine. So if you convert that and parallel to continuous improvement, similarly. So if you look at, again, infections, say in the ICU, you know, you need to wash your hands. You know that we need to use certain techniques to put the line in. We know you need to use certain antibiotics. But now we're taking care of patients, say, that are immunocompromised or patients that are transplanted. Well, they're going to need a different set of personalization to those improvements so that for those patients, they get the same good outcomes as a patient that perhaps isn't a transplant patient. So I often say that it's, you know, it's really trying to fine tune, add art to a science that mm-hmm. allows us to at least start the process of improvement.
Yeah. So maybe let's take a step back then to, you know, what you described as the system level of improvement, from singular improvements to system level, you know, this ideal of a culture of continuous improvement in healthcare. Like, how would you describe that? What are the elements that you would expect to see in a culture of continuous improvement?
Continuous improvement in healthcare is something that really takes discipline and has to be worked at. It takes leaders that truly endorse curiosity and the sense that you never get to a finish line, but you always want to do things even better. A culture of continuous improvement in healthcare also requires the enablement of it. So it needs systems like electronic medical records. It needs antibiotic algorithms. It needs good training programs. It needs the right type of skills within the healthcare system so that the system is enabled to provide the best care. And then truly, if you believe in continuous improvement as always looking at what you've done, seeing if you could do it better, every time you get to a good place, you see if you can get to a better place for those patients and for the population you serve.
So I'd be curious to hear more about enablement and the role of leaders, you know, because it would be one thing to do training, whether we certify people or train them to whatever length of time. But if the environment doesn't allow people to use the problem-solving skills that they were exposed to in that training, it might be all for naught. So from your experience, like, what are things leaders at different levels can do or need to do to really make sure that enablement is there?
Excellent question, because continuous improvement within a system is totally dependent on multiple stakeholders, and in particular, the leaders within the organization. I'll give you an example that resonates deeply with me. I completed my MBOE. I was a Lean Six Sigma black belt, and I went to see my CEO at the time. And what I needed from him and what he was able to provide to me as a chief quality officer was the audience for me to be in front of the board, for me to be able to produce and report on quality outcomes as the first agenda item on the board meeting. You know, he enabled me to be in front of the right people to see the importance of quality outcomes, and for me to be in front of the right people when things weren't going so well and we needed the support of the board, either for funding or other system opportunities. So he didn't, Dr. Gabby, who was the CEO at the time of Wexner Medical Center, did not need to be a black belt in Six Sigma, but he needed to understand the importance of continuous improvement and the importance of a chief quality officer being able to do her job. And that's what he enabled: the right audience, the right opportunity to provide what was going well, what wasn't going well, and then to always be able to come forward with problems and solutions when needed.
So I'm guessing then that tone or that example from the top then flowed through you to other leaders throughout the organization?
It has to. It has to cascade. Now, it's not always adopted as if you turn a light switch on. It does take some effort. It does take an ability to be able to engage with other stakeholders, share where the opportunities are, share how we might improve things together, and always center the patient in that work so that for whatever stakeholder, they understand the why. Then you help them with the how, and then you measure with them so we can see whether or not it really improved the environment or the patient outcome that they are part of.
Yeah. So maybe we can take a look at some more specific examples, kind of come back down a level. Things that affect patients, reducing patient safety events, for example. I was wondering if you could, well, maybe along those lines, talk about the why, the how, and some of the measures, how that success was accomplished.
Yes, I would love to. One particular example that we had at the Wexner Medical Center that I think was maybe one of the greatest accomplishments of the team that I was able to be part of was reducing falls for patients that were in the hospital. So the why was that we had patients that were falling in the hospital. And so we had to prevent that because these patients are vulnerable. These patients have medical issues. And to also then have a fall within the hospital led to very, very unfavorable outcomes. We were able to bring together multiple teams, nurses, physicians, physiotherapists, students, even ward clerks and ward aides that were answering call bells and such within the hospital, and come together with the patient to see what the solutions might be. We then had a series of tests of change that we were able to put in place. And then it became such that we were measuring every day how many patients fell. And it was immediately reported out if we had a patient fall, so that everybody was aware of how important it was to get to a zero fall day. And when that happened, celebration, the pride amongst the team was palpable.
So that immediate reporting is something people don't always have or don't always talk about. So, like, you know, from our origins at Value Capture, that was something Paul O'Neill emphasized. Yes. As CEO of Alcoa, that immediate reporting, that as CEO, regardless of anywhere around the world, if there was a problem, he wanted to know about it immediately so there could be,
yes,
rapid response, rapid problem solving. I was wondering if you just sort of elaborate on the importance of that and how that reporting hopefully then turned into effective problem solving, positive progress, as opposed to, you know, I imagine sometimes people might be afraid of, oh no, reporting is going to mean blame or punishment.
That's right. That's right. We have to be really thoughtful about that immediate reporting, that it's not the shame and the blame, but it's rather how you can make things better in the moment. Very early on in quality improvement, I think what we were finding is that we were trying to do these root cause analysis of an event that had happened a month ago. You know, very difficult to know exactly what happened, what the variables were, what was going on with the patient. And so moving to that real-time reporting became important. In order to do that, you have to do that within a safe culture and be able to do it such that, you know, when you hear of these events, first you see if you can stabilize the patient, see how you can address and help the patient, how you help the provider that this might have happened to in that environment, make sure the doctor, the nurse, whomever was involved is feeling safe and protected, and then immediately do a rapid root cause analysis to see how to prevent it, and then to make the solution, the problem never happen again. There are many great great examples of this across the nation. The institution that comes to my mind immediately is the Cincinnati Children's Hospital that has real-time reporting every day. It's obvious to everyone. And not that they know exactly what the event was, but they know when a patient safety event has happened. And in the moment, everybody takes a pause and sees how best they can help address the issue, not blame what happened, but set an accountability framework in place to go forward in a better way.
Yeah. It seems like one of the benefits of being a system, I think it's in your bio at one point, you had 7 hospitals.
Yes,
that you were working with.
Yes, yes.
Within that system. So it seems like there would be a huge opportunity to not have every unit or every hospital working in isolation. Like, how did that reporting lead to sharing knowledge of risk or knowledge about how to eliminate said risk?
Yeah, that's actually the beauty of working within a system is that you actually have 7 or multiple stakeholders, more resources and more ideas of how to improve problems. One of the challenges, though, and it is something just to be mindful of, is that when you roll out a program or you roll out an improvement strategy, it really needs to be holistic. And we had the mantra that unless every hospital did it, we wouldn't proceed. And so it took a lot of engagement up front, but it also made us address problems that affected everyone. And so that really helped us holistically address issues that were really system-wide. It's not to say that each hospital didn't have their own initiatives around situations that were inclusive of just that type of patient that was in that hospital. But when you are trying to reduce infections or falls, it really has to be at the system level. And really because the patient, regardless of where they are in the system, they should feel the same patient safety strategies, regardless of which bed they're in within mm-hmm. in that system.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like there's, ethical or moral obligation to spread some of these practices as quickly as you can. So we don't want to say, well, this unit's the control group where we expect more people are going to fall because we haven't implemented things yet. I mean, there's a different. It's different than doing, let's say, a double blind controlled study on a medication. It's a different type of science that way.
It is. Implementation science is like that. You know, you really have to do it at a system level if you want to make system change. And then beyond that, you know, what we were able to do at the Wexner Medical Center was then actually disseminate beyond our walls, and to other peers, to other organizations and institutions, what we were doing. So to improve outcomes elsewhere. And that was really, really impactful. In fact, every year we publish somewhere between 12 and 16 research papers that were only based on the work that we were doing in continuous improvement. And so really, really elevating the science to the point where it was in the peer review literature.
Mm. So, you know, with this focus on, you know, a couple of things you mentioned, you know, talking about patient safety events, cross-functional teams and participation from different disciplines, tests of change. I'd be curious to maybe if you can talk a little bit about reducing hospital readmissions, because that seems like the type of thing that screams system problem that requires cross-functional, cross-departmental collaboration. Tell us about some of the successes you had there.
Yeah, reducing readmissions is such a such an important initiative in hospitals, not only from the efficiency of the hospital itself, but from the patient experience. You know, when a patient is discharged, they want to go home and they want to stay home. And so it's really an important issue. We were able to address it from multiple stakeholder involvement, the physician that was discharging the patient themselves, but then also looking at the community supports. So if you have a patient that gets discharged, but they don't have the medications at the pharmacy so that they can take the right medicines to keep them at home, then you have a community-based issue. And so whenever we had a readmission, we do a small a root cause analysis and look at all the different components that influence that readmission. And then we would address each of those issues within the hospital walls and in the community as well, that were even more important than what was happening in the hospital.
And the measures, I guess there's readmission rates as the core measure. Are there related measures that you could use to see if you're making progress more quickly, or does that translate pretty quickly into the readmission rates?
So there's balancing and counterbalancing metrics with readmission rates. So you can measure the readmission rates as a one metric, but then you have to balance that with the length of stay. So you don't want to keep a patient in the hospital so long that you get to a point that it would be impossible for them to be readmitted because they're completely resolved in whatever clinical dilemma they had. So that's a countering measure. But the one that I think is much more important is patient experience. So within the patient experience domain, there's certain components of it. You know, was my medication explained to me? Did the team give me a great, you know, a good way to figure out how best to care for myself at home if I had an issue? I think that really looking at from the patient reported outcomes, it was much more impactful to understand how our continuous improvement was working or not working to help those patients not be readmitted.
So, yeah, and it seemed like that it's interesting to think about the counterbalancing, because if somebody else was doing a project trying to help reduce length of stay,
that's
readmission
right.
Readmission rates are a counterbalance to that.
Right. And you always have to measure. Absolutely. So, for instance, if you're measuring readmissions, the counterbalance would be length of stay. If you are, say you are trying to measure, quiet at night from a patient satisfaction, on the same hand, you want to make sure you don't have any patient safety events that are making it such that it's not helpful for the patient. So you always have to think about what are the failure modes to the continuous improvement that you put in place and the metrics that are being recorded. Always think about what are the unintended consequences mm-hmm. of a very good improvement strategy.
Yeah. So maybe stepping back to the system level again, of the different things that you and other leaders are doing to try to encourage or create this culture of continuous improvement, were there, you know, some lessons learned along the way, things that you would have done differently, you know, things that you discovered maybe through different tests of change at a system level?
Yeah, I think that there are lots of lessons learned in continuous improvement. You know, I think that's part of the beauty of it and why I think it's something that I've been so humbled to be part of for almost two decades. I think lessons learned is that you cannot over-communicate. You have to communicate, and communicate in different ways. I think the pandemic has shown us that. I think that you can never over-engage stakeholders. And I think the most important one that I wish I had maybe known even earlier in my career, is that ask the patient first and then make sure that you implement with their voice at the heart of that implementation.
Can you think of an example? I mean, that's a powerful statement. An example or even a scenario of, you know, something that might not go well if we don't get that direct voice of the patient, if we assume we know what the patient wants or needs.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of scenarios that come to mind. Maybe a larger example, and then maybe a smaller example. You know, there's a lot of tension out there around public reporting, what patients want to know and what they want to see when they come into a hospital. I think early on in our career, we thought that, you know, making it really clear with a big poster on the wall that what your infection rate was or your hand hygiene rate was on a floor was something the patient wanted. We went to meet the patients and they're like, no, we trust in you. So that when you think, you know, transparency is always thought to be the best, it may not be when you're vulnerable as a patient, right? Mm. Yeah. Another example was when we were actually designing the hospital rooms for the new hospital at The Ohio State University. I think we had a sense, looking at all the literature and all the human factors work, et cetera, what an ideal room setup would be. We mocked it up with cardboard and styrofoam, right. Put the patients in it, and they were moving things all over the place. So, yeah. You know, I'm glad we did that before we, you know, poured the mm-hmm. concrete. So.
It's a powerful example of prototyping and doing small tests of change when it's still affordable to make changes.
Yes, yes, yes. Cardboard is much better than concrete. Yes.
Yes. So I wanted to ask one other question, Susan, about you know, surgeons and continuous improvement. Like, I think, you know, there are so many opportunities. You know, the little bit of time I've spent in these parts of the hospitals, you know, opportunities to improve processes, to provide better service to the surgeons and their patients. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, your thoughts on, like, you know, using continuous improvement to support surgeons, and then does that become maybe an on-ramp to get surgeons participating more in continuous improvement?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a really good observation. I think first and foremost in surgery, because we can measure outcomes pretty reasonably now, there's many good national organizations that really measure patient outcomes that are meaningful. I think that's really helped surgeons be mindful, be aware, and help them to implement change because they can measure whether or not the improvements are making a difference or not. I think too, because of that, and because of the, you know, there's certain public pressures to be very transparent with surgical outcomes, more and more surgeons in their training programs, in their residency programs, learn about continuous improvement very early on in their career. You know, at the Royal College, in all of our surgical disciplines and our specialty disciplines, continuous improvement, quality improvement is a core a piece of their learning. And so I think that we are now able to bring surgeons along that have some of that information, some of that training, so that becomes more innate to their practice. And then I do think I have seen over the past decade, more and more surgeons become involved in quality improvement, continuous improvement, and do more training. You know, at our national meetings, there's often a whole day or two with very good training for surgeons of all types in quality improvement, patient safety, and many are doing programs like the Masters of Operational Excellence because it advances their practice and helps mm-hmm. them to affect the systems that they're working in.
So that's good to hear. I was about to ask you if you were the only surgeon in your class, or there's more coming into it, hopefully other physicians.
Many more, and all kinds of different surgeons. Yeah, neurosurgeons, orthopedic surgeons. We have a fairly robust group of us. And like I say, it's now becoming a key component to our national meetings and conferences because it is as important as some of the basic science that is coming forward.
Yeah. And for regular listeners, we'll remember back in episode 25, I had a chance to interview Aravind Chandrasekaran, the academic director currently at the MBOE program.
And, yes.
I've had a chance to visit that program. And it seems like great people, great program.
Yes. AC Aravind did a great project with us as surgeons to actually reduce readmissions among kidney transplant patients. I mean, it was a phenomenal phenomenal project he worked with us. Nurses, physicians, patients, the outpatient clinics, and it really improved the outcomes of our patients that were getting a kidney transplant. It was an amazing project.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's an amazing why behind that one. And that's so powerful in healthcare.
It was amazing. And, you know, it was so interesting what people show you that you're looking at and you don't notice. What AC showed us was that for one kidney transplant patient, if they went home, they had 8 different ways that told them how much water to consume. One document would say a little bit. The next one would say 2 glasses. The third one would say 1 liter. You know, so just standardizing some of the education. But, you know, mm-hmm. we're seeing it every day. You don't notice it.
Yeah. Well, that's where maybe the patient perspective, the opportunity to get some of their feedback, or, I hope I wouldn't be in that situation, but yeah, I would notice that, and I would try to say something, but then the question is who owns that?
What are you going
to
do with it? Exactly?
Who do I tell?
Yes.
So I know there's questions around, coordination of care, and then that question of coordination of the system.
Absolutely. And there's no improvement that's too small. So simply aligning those information sheets helped tremendously to reduce the readmission rate amongst those patients and improve their satisfaction.
Yeah. So maybe one last question for you, Susan. Thinking of people who are listening who, in their organization, they're trying to foster this culture of continuous improvement, or they're trying to move things along and build momentum. Do you have a piece of advice that you would pass along to them?
Yes. Well, first of all, I would thank them tremendously, because it is the gift that keeps on giving. There's always opportunities to improve. I think patience and humility in this work are absolutely key. You'll always be in a rush to improve things, but you have to slow down sometimes to make it right. And then secondly, humility for the patient's perspective, humility for what really is going to improve, and then being so grateful and humble when you do make an improvement and that patient has a better outcome than you had anticipated. That's a wonderful feeling, and it really is at the core of what we're doing here.
Those are great reminders or great ideas. It might be the first time somebody is hearing those tips. And thank you, Susan, for sharing those. So again, our guest here today has been Dr. Susan Moffitt-Bruce, currently the CEO of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. So thank you. Thank you so much for being here today, and really enjoyed the discussion.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Habitual Excellence, presented by Value Capture. We hope you'll subscribe to the podcast, and please also rate and review it in your favorite podcast directory or app. To learn more about Value Capture and how we can help your organization on this journey to habitual excellence, visit our website at www.valuecapturellc.com.